It's Wednesday, February 16, 2011. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Well, did it or didn't it? Did social media make the decisive difference on the ground in Egypt and Tunisia? Or was it just a fable that indeed that particular set of revolutions was fueled by a digital revolution? Well, as the evidence now comes in, it's clear it did make a difference. Not only digital media in general, but Facebook and Google, and especially Twitter in particular. Now, what happened that made this so possible? Well, what happened is that these forms of new digital transformation and communication are so quick and they create crowds of interest so immediately that it is almost impossible for any governmental agency or institution to put it to a stop. What you had in terms of the communication going on was that persons were able to send tweets immediately about where persons should organize, where they should gather, what they should do, what's the messaging, who's the responding where, and what's the danger, where are you likely to get arrested, how can you avoid having tear gas bring you injury. When you start looking at all this, you realize that the world has changed on this question in a matter of months. Just several months ago, when there were uprisings in Iran, the Twitter revolution turned out to be something of a dud. At least that was the story. The story was that the digital revolution basically allowed all these young people in Iran to communicate with one another, but it did not lead to the critical mass of anything that could be described as an uprising or indeed a successful revolution. Well, just ask those who were in power just a matter of weeks ago in Tunisia or days ago in Egypt. The world has turned upside down when it comes to these digital media, and the United States government is now taking very clear attention. Evidence of that comes with reports that the United States is now sending out messages to Iranians in Farsi on Twitter. Indeed, the United States is fueling what already is leading to protests and to revolt that is brewing now in Iran. The front page of Tuesday's edition of the New York Times has the headline, "Iran uses force against protests as region erupts." Neil McFarquhar and Alan Cowell report that the size of the protests in Iran are unclear. However, estimates suggest that perhaps 20,000 to 30,000 demonstrators in several cities have defied stern warnings and have taken to the streets. Now listen to this next paragraph from their report. "The unrest was an acute embarrassment for Iranian leaders who had sought to portray the toppling of two secular rulers in Tunisia and Egypt as a triumph of popular support for Islam in the Arab world." Now, there is the other lesson about social media. It turns out that it's very difficult for totalitarian governments not only to control the medium, but for them to control the message. The message that the Iranian leaders wanted broadcast to their people, and of which they wished to take advantage in terms of world opinion, was that Mubarak and the leader of Tunisia had been removed from power because they were lackeys of the United States of America, and that the revolutions were done in the name of Islam. It's not turning out that way. At least immediately what's on the ground in Tunisia and Egypt is not exactly at this point what you would call a Muslim uprising. There are fears there and concerns looking long range, but it's certainly nothing like the Islamic revolution that happened in Iran several decades ago. And it's the Iranian leaders who now have to wonder if they're about to be tweeted out of their sources and seats of power. It'll be fascinating to see how this develops, but it is interesting that the United States, in terms of its government, has basically, in just a short amount of time, reversed itself on this question. And in terms of a great reversal, some of it is taking place in terms of at least some major European media when it comes to the presidency of George W. Bush. When President Bush was in office, especially as related to the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, he was roundly criticized, indeed condemned, and, well, it's hard to come up with a word other than vilified, in the liberal press of Germany, the Netherlands, Belgium. You go across Europe, and with the exception of at least some newspapers and media sources in the United Kingdom, President Bush was rather roundly criticized. Now, Der Spiegel, one of the most important of the German news magazines, has come out to ask if indeed what people are saying now isn't what President George W. Bush had been saying all along. As a matter of fact, when the United States government is criticized for not backing democracy in the Arab world and especially in the Islamic world, well, it turns out that the messaging that was offered by President George W. Bush, that very messaging for which he was so roundly criticized, is what these liberal media outlets have found themselves saying. And at least Der Spiegel had the courage and honesty to come back and say, as we hear ourselves speak, we think we have heard these words before. And it sounds very much like what President George W. Bush was saying. Do they see this as the vindication of history? Well, not yet. But they do see, at least, that language does matter. And one of the interesting things going on, even in the cover of this week's Newsweek magazine, is a pretty thorough critique of the incumbent American President Barack Obama's language, and his leadership is related to both Tunisia and Egypt. More encouragingly, it looks like, as the United States government is now putting energy on the ground and in the air and in the Twitterverse in places like Iran and Yemen, it may still make a difference. Speaking of Yemen, that country that is the source of so much of the Muslim terrorism, the Islamic terrorism, it is now experiencing its fifth day of protests. And as violence has broken out in Yemen, the calls for the end of the authoritarian rule of President Abdullah Saleh is now reaching something of a fever pitch. Now, we're starting to add up how many times we have said in recent days and months, and especially in the last few weeks, we didn't see this coming. We didn't think it was going to happen. Well, here's one last thought I want to offer on this entire picture of what's going on in the Middle East and beyond. Whether you are a Republican, a Democrat, an American, or a European, you can join in the conversation of who should have known what when. But one of the humbling aspects of history is that very important events happened, or happened in a way that no one predicted or saw at the time. There is a real argument to be made here that what was going on in Tunisia and in Egypt and now in Yemen and Jordan and Lebanon and, yes, Iran, was unpredictable by the very fact that it had not been planned until the opportunity arose. It's going to be very interesting to see if anyone's able to say, "I told you so," at the end of this series of historical occurrences. A couple of other things to watch here. Now, when you start thinking of people criticizing the United States for having had the relationship with Egypt, you'll hear people such as Anderson Cooper on CNN suggesting that, after all, as he visited Egypt, there was much anger toward the United States on the ground. There's a good discussion to be had there. But let's point out something very interesting. CNN is not on the ground in Iran. In other words, there are lands where the United States is vilified, but they still have enough respect for the United States that American media are able to be on the ground. When it comes to other authoritarian governments, they make very, very, very clear that the media are not welcome when they're about to do their dirty work on their own citizens. Going back to the Reagan administration and all the way back, indeed, to Roosevelt, Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, and beyond, one of the decision points the United States government had to make was whether or not it would befriend nations that it had serious issues about and concerns about when it came to how they treated their own citizens, how they would relate to those nations in the process of trying to win a Cold War. That meant the United States had allies that did not share our values, did not share our governmental system, did not even share our respect for human rights. Trying to balance all of that is very, very difficult. And even as there is a very important discussion that should be centered on those issues right now, and indeed a very critical discussion looking at the history of the United States, one of the things we need to remember is that in a fallen, sinful world, it is impossible for the United States or any other nation to think that it can control all these things on our own terms. If nothing else, what's gone on in recent days should serve to humble all of us as we see how world occurrence and the unfolding of world history doesn't go according to anyone's specific plan. We were speaking of the influence of Twitter, and in particular in Egypt and Tunisia. How about the iPad as a technology? Now barely a year old, well, it's already making a difference. I say barely a year, it's not actually quite a year old, but it seems like it's become so important to so many lives that we don't know how we would do without it. That's the way of technology. Technology works its way into our lives and develops what the late Jacques Ellul, the French theologian, called the technological imperative. Well, it also opens some opportunities. Now, how about this? Business Week magazine, the current issue, reports that in Japan, the iPad is becoming the home library. A man is identified here, Satoshi Tagamori, who started having nightmares at the bookshelves lining his cramped living room would rain heavy tomes on his baby. Armed with a cutting board, the 28-year-old pharmaceutical company employee chopped his 850 titles to fit inside a cheap scanner and converted each book into a PDF file that's now on his tablet computer. Now, he did that because the average family domicile in Japan is less than half that of the average American home, and that's especially true in a place like Tokyo. But where the space is invaluable, it turns out that digitalizing books is at least one way that someone can have a library of several hundred titles without endangering the life of the infant that may be surrounded by sagging bookcases. Is this the way of the future? Well, there's a great deal of debate about that. But I just have to tell you, as I look at this, and even as I myself read things on a Kindle and I read books on the Kindle app, on the iPad, and other electronic devices, there's still nothing quite like the book. Nicholas Carr points out that a digital device offers opportunities for distraction as well as for reading and reflection. The book is pretty much just what it is. It's a book. And a part of why it becomes such an important means of escape and even mental rescue for us is that there is not the temptation to get the book to do something else, like play a game or receive an email or tweet a tweet. We'll be watching stories having to do with the development of the gay marriage issue and the normalization of homosexuality in different circles. But one particularly has my attention today, and it's an ominous sign of what could be coming elsewhere. The Church of England, which is, after all, the official church of the United Kingdom, is now the subject of proposed legislation that would require the Church of England to allow same-sex ceremonies to go on inside its churches with approval. Now, this is not now called marriage, but it is a right that is basically tantamount to marriage. And the Church of England has opposed the using of its church facilities for the solemnation of same-sex couples. But what we have in this story is that the British Parliament is considering, with a move that is announced by the Equalities Minister, the British government, to require the church to do this. And it may not, even according to some authorities in Great Britain, require parliamentary approval. It might just be done by the government. Of course, under a parliamentary system of government, the government has a majority, so it is insured of a parliamentary success on something like this if it's not a free vote. The bottom line in all this is that change is coming to the Church of England, and it's a change that is now basically, however you want to package it, a form of coercion. And there are those in the United States who say that would never happen here. Well, we do not have a state church. We do not have an Erastian system of government where we have the government able to dictate terms to the church in just this way. But there are other means of governmental persuasion and coercion than these. So when they say it can't happen or it won't happen, well, we're taking this step now and the next step will never be taken. Well, just remember the developments that are now so ominously taking shape in the United Kingdom. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. For information about Southern Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information about Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/AlbertMoeller. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.